buildings. We're now waiting for Verrazano to get started. Like, we actually started getting some faculty together. And they kept saying they were going to start their school. And it didn't happen, until finally Atlantic City got gambling. And then Verrazano went out of business, and they sold the college. And Saratoga was still looking for something, and you know what they turned to? The arts. They got the Saratoga Performing Arts Center up there, where they have the New York City Ballet, and they've given the town some reason for being, which it did not have once it had lost the waters. They still have that racetrack, but it's only open 24 days a year. Anyway, it is interesting that cities are still having that same kind of a problem. I bring you greetings from New York City, which was at one time the only theater that this country had. I hope that you are all aware of that. And why did all of this great big country, all of our professional theater, ended up in one 20-block area? That all got started because of the way this country got founded. The Dutch brought their culture here when they came here first to New Amsterdam, and they did not have any theater. There was not any theater in New York City for a long time. Part of what got it coming over here was when Cromwell kicked all those touring companies out of England, and they came to the English-speaking world over here, and we got companies going, but it was companies of traveling players. And eventually, they started coming in to play New York as New York started getting other people that had that theater-going habit. And a few of them were from mainly the Middle European countries. And New York at that time also had mainly boarding houses. All of those people had to go outside for their entertainment, so theater was one of the main things they had. And eventually we started having a vertical style of living, which we have to this day. And again, we don't have backyards, so we have to go outside not only to eat for entertainment, but also to go to theater, and that's where theater got thriving there. So all these traveling companies started coming into New York, and eventually New York became their longest stand, and an awful lot of them started using New York as a base. And it became their home, and they would then go outside of New York to travel and get some extra weeks, but New York was their longest stand. It was set up very much like a road company. It is to this day. Every single one of those theaters is set up exactly like any road theater, and all you do is when you come in there, you're coming in for a week if things don't go well, or maybe for a couple of years if things do go well. What then started happening, I think, now this is one of the things you've got to remember. All these things I'm telling you are my ideas, and a lot of them are kind of crazy, and most people don't agree with them. So don't worry if you think, gee, I don't mind, because I'm used to hearing people say, I don't believe that. These are just my feelings of what has happened and what has happened to theater and where it's going. And believe me, I will try to relate this to the outdoor drama eventually. I hope. With all of these people starting to spend more and more time in New York, what then started happening is they started manufacturing a product. It was like a business. All these people who were there manufacturing this product, which they then exported to other countries, or they took it out on road tours. But there was not theater anywhere else, with a few exceptions. There were either schools or they were quasi-community theaters. But there were about a half a dozen of those around the country. But the main place for theater, professional theater, was in New York City. And that's why everybody went there. That's why I went there when I left Chapel Hill, even though Prof. Conscience said, decentralize. Well, we've started to decentralize, but it's taken the destruction, really, of that, what I think is was an acting company there. With everybody working there and living there, we used to take plays out of town and try them out for a couple of weeks and then come back and work on them again. You could put the actor back in that city, and he wouldn't go anywhere because he had nowhere else to go. That's the only place he could work. Movies came along, and they started doing movies out in California, but they, again, if you look at them, were all movie companies. They were companies of actors. MGM, if you look at a bunch of those MGM movies that were all done in the 30s, if you viewed them one after another, you'd find that you're seeing the same actors, particularly all those marvelous character actors. Most of them had come from the theater, but the theater survived that move, those people out there. People didn't go back and forth. Again, this has to do with something else, which is what moves any society along, which is your communication and transportation. And it's affecting everything we're doing all the time. It took too long to get out to California, for one thing, in those days. So we were able to do theater and write theater for those particular people. Noel Coward wrote for the Lunts. Phil Berry wrote for Katharine Hepburn. Even Rodgers and Hammerstein were writing, knowing Mary Martin was going to be doing that. I, a couple of years ago, was going to try to revive a musical, a Hammerstein musical that had been done in the 20s. And I talked to Billy Hammerstein, and he said, "You'll never make it." He said, "That musical did open in 29, just before the crash, and closed rather abruptly and got very, very good reviews. But it was written specifically for Helen Morgan and Charlie Butterworth." And he said, "Unless you've got a Helen Morgan and a Charlie Butterworth, you're never going to get that play off the ground." And he was quite right. It was one that was not actor-proof. It was really written for those people. Shakespeare wrote for his company. We did a marvelous show last year called MacReady, a one-man piece that was done by Frank Barry, an English actor. And MacReady lived for, he dominated the stage between 1810 and 1850. He had over 50 roles written for him. Lord Byron wrote for him. Dickens wrote for him. A whole lot of people wrote for him. People, authors writing for specific actors. And we had plays being written for all of those actors during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and into the 50s. What happened to that acting company was television. We absorbed radio quite well, because people were doing radio as well as doing plays. Then television came along, and we started doing television, live television, in those golden age of television. And most of the actors working in theater also worked in television. And a very small segment of people had television sets in those days in New York City. And those people were the same people that went to theater. So the kind of theater that we were doing on television was aimed for those specific people. And the advertisers wanted to support that because they wanted those people to watch it so that they would buy their product. Then as more and more people got television sets, it kept spreading out. And the level of television, I do believe, started going down and down and down, and I'm not even sure it's hit the bottom yet. I don't think it was an accident myself that Fred Silverman went from one network to the other, bringing them all down at the same level. Because he did have his finger right on the pulse of what people would buy, and they're trying to sell products to all these people out there. And everybody has at least one television. A lot of people, two and three of them. We're eventually all going to have one in every room, which will bring us to another thing later on. But we are into that age of computers and television. The communication and transportation system are vital if you're going to look at the history of anything, because it is what I believe is moves any society along. Our country was founded with sail and mail, and it was developed with the rail and the telegraph. And any of you that were in the Second World War know that it was the railroad that moved us all. I mean, I didn't take one airplane trip the entire war, except for one time when I was overseas, just to jump from Pearl Harbor to Fiji or somewhere. But otherwise, you were going totally either by ship or by rail. That was our main means of transportation. Communication was the telegraph. I had to know the Morse code. That was when I came back. I didn't call home. I lived in Rochester, New York. You call from the West Coast to Rochester, first of all, it would cost you about $10. You know, that's one of the few things that has gone down. in Price, is the price of a long distance call. Just one of the very few. I think the other was chicken. The only other things that stayed the same, there's one thing that has stayed the same, that's the mink coats. They were expensive then, they still are. But and the two things that have gone up the most since then, this is just extra information where you are, medical expenses and education, tuitions and colleges. Those are the things that have gone up the most. But anyway, it was very expensive to call home, so you didn't do it. Besides that, you had to give up a whole day. If anybody remembers what it was like making it a long-distance phone call. There have been big changes since that time. I believe, personally, that we've gone through at least three, probably four means of communication and transportation since 1945. And that has caused our whole world to just kind of tumble. We are in, I do believe, now, the space age. And we have to be thinking that we're traveling at the speed of a spaceship, not a jet plane. And the only way we can keep up with that is to have a communication system that will allow us to do that, and so that is computers. We have immediate live visual communication with the moon, and we're traveling at that speed. The thing that gives us such turmoil is the fact that some parts of this world are still traveling by ox cart and communicating by drum. And there are times when I feel that that's the way we communicate in New York. The communication, everybody keeps saying our big problem is communication, and it is. And it's also that we don't even know how to use a lot of it. I don't think we've learned yet how to use television. I don't even think we've learned yet how to use the phone, even. But these things have a daily effect on all of us. And anything that is affecting any one of us as a person is affecting us, affecting our theater. Because theater is a reflection, certainly, of what is happening within life. And we have to be conscious of that, because it does affect us all the time as a means of communication. Theater is still, to a large extent, a handcrafted business. You've got eight people in the company, you've got to have eight people. And it's something that we need to be telling our government all the time. If you've got a problem with unemployment, have more theaters, have more arts. If you need a 100-piece orchestra, it takes 100 people to do it. Let more people do that. You can automate building tanks and planes and guns. But you can't automate the theater that way. It'll give us a whole lot more important if everybody becomes an artist. Of course, that's not going to happen, as you know. But anyway, that is one thing that can happen for us. But around our artist, we must surround him with a good communication system. And that's one of the reasons I think we have to get into computers. We're computerizing an awful lot of things within Circle Rep. Even though we're a tiny company, we have 160 seats. It is 45 actors, 21 playwrights, 11 directors, and about a dozen designers. But they are very good people. We have Bill Hurt is one of our actors. Judd Hirsch is one of our actors. Chris Reeves. There are a lot of others, maybe not as well known. Sam Shepard is one of our playwrights. David Mamet, Lanford Wilson, Terrence McNally, John Bishop. Our designers, John Lee Beatty and Dennis Parisi, both who just won awards in New York. It is a company of terrific artists. I believe very much in the artist. I believe the actor is the most important person working in the theater. I believe the audience the most important person coming into the theater. And it behooves us to have the best artist, well-trained, working in each one of our theaters. Our problem that we have in this country is that we don't have acting companies. I do believe, as I pointed out, that company that we had in New York was an acting company. And it all dissolved back in 1958 when it became as expensive to do live television as it to do film. And the City Fathers, who were at that time, you remember, Bob, they were looking at the Roosevelt Field, and they were going to turn it into a television city, and didn't. And all television suddenly moved to the West Coast, and it took all the actors. As Mel Brooks says, if you're a coal miner, you go where the coal is. And that's where the work was, so they all went out there. And they all made a good deal of money. But it left us with nobody to cast. Then we started doing plays poorly back in the 60s, until suddenly some people came along that said that they didn't need actors or playwrights or anything. And they put on halflings, and we got hair. But you didn't have to have the theater, the spoken word. It was just a happening that went on. And stuff was going on, but it was a frightening time. Everybody thought it was all going to die. Everyone always thinks the theater's going to die. That's never going to happen, I don't think. Even though we may end up losing all of television and movies at some time, I don't think that's going to happen to theater. Although there are a lot of people that think that movies and television are just going to continue on forever. Maybe it will. I don't know. But what happened was we lost at least one generation, if not longer, of theater-trained actors. Because what needed to be done was the lunts of the 60s should have been passing on their knowledge, their superstitions, their traditions onto another group of young actors coming along. But there were no lunts there. There was nobody there. The people that should have been, that had worked with the lunts, like Marlon Brando, should have been, passing his craft on, but he left it. He abandoned theater. I'm not blaming any of those actors, but they abandoned theater in order to make a living. So what happened? There were no actors around. That whole theater company had disappeared. It was about that I was trying to form a company called Solar, the Society of Loose Actors Revolving, trying to take all of those people that had worked in theater at one time, and we're now out on the West Coast, and it was a group of 32 actors. George Cusard was one of them. George C. Scott, people like that. We said, well, we're going to go up and we will do plays up at Stockbridge, up at the Berkshire Theater Festival. And we read one play, a new play, and we had in it Hume Cronin, Marty Balsam, Eli Wallach, Fritz Weaver, Richard Kiley, George Grizzard, Anne Bancroft, Jessica Tandy, and it was a company like that. But you can give a company like that the phone book and let them read it, and you will get an audience. We could have put that play right on Broadway. The play, however, was not very good. But that's what you have, is the best people. Doing theater is like baking, I think. It's one of the things. It's like a lot of other things. But if you're going to, you have to start out with the best ingredients. If you're going to bake an apple pie, you don't start out with the ingredients to do an angel food cake. Your play is your recipe. The ingredients you put in it are those actors. They've got to be the best actors. If you start out with rotten apples, it's not going to make a very good... If you start out with rancid butter, it's not going to help that. You've got to have very good people. The talent of the actor is vital. The next thing, and something that we've neglected in this country very, very much, is the training of that actor. And the third thing we never have ever worked on, which is giving that actor the time to take that training and his talent and mold it into being a great performer. Why? Because we don't have those companies that they can go to. We're just beginning with the Circle Rep toward that kind of an idea. Now, it's happening to a certain extent around the country. During that explosion of 58, if you look at all, do any of you know the TCG book, the Theater Communications Group book about the theater profiles? If you look at all of those companies in there and how few of them existed before 1960. Now, part of it was the Ford Foundation, part of it was the New York City Arts Council, and 65 when the NEA started coming in. But that money started coming after something needed to be done. Because there's this explosion that happened out of New York City. All the actors that Hollywood wanted, they took, and they could offer the kind of money that theater couldn't compete with. That's one thing that we should never try to do. We cannot compete on an economic level, but we must not try to do what movies can do better, anyway, or what television can do better. Because theater can do something better than either one of them. And these people that were not wanted by television land out there had to go somewhere. So a lot of them started theaters of their own. In Seattle, you know, in San Francisco, they started going, and the next thing you know, we have now, I think they're servicing something like TCG is servicing something like 165 different not-for-profit theaters in this country. And probably 160 of them didn't exist before 1960. So it has started. A lot of them went lousy when they started. But a city like Seattle might have thought they were terrific. Why? Because they'd never had anything there. Could they have worked in New York? Probably not. I think there's a reason why New York City, Boston, and Philadelphia has never been able to have a regional theater grab a hold, because those three cities had that Broadway audience, was used to having the very best theater America had to offer, and they wanted to see the best. I'm not saying that all of those regional theaters were doing terrible work. They were doing the very best they could with what they had in the way of money and with the way of talent. And it started coming up, and if you, any of you watched any of them develop, some of them are getting very, very good. And they're starting to be able to bring things into New York, and it's starting to happen. They're bringing their ware into the city, and it's happening there. Now, if any of you have been reading the stuff that's going on in New York, you know that there's a lot of activity there in those Broadway houses, but it's not the kind of theater that we had 20 years ago. This is a Coney Island theater for the most part. It's become very, very expensive. Most of them are musicals. The majority of things that are going well there, of what I term the serious theater, has come out of either England, which is a subsidized theater, or come out of our regional theater development. Most of the plays like Children of a Lesser God, Tally's Folly, 5th of July. So many of the things that have come out of either Circle Rep, Manhattan Theater Club, the Mark Tabor Forum, they're coming out of this regional theater movement, this decentralization of the theater. But it's funny that it really took almost the destruction of that other company, that New York company, in order to get this thing started. I don't think it could have started any other way. The audience is gradually happening out in the hinterlands. I hate using that word because we should, but we have to, because my gosh, when you think of a country this size that had theater only in one city, it wasn't just theater. That was our main place for all of the arts. But as you know, it's happening all over the country with our operas and our orchestras and our ballet companies too. Those are starting to go. But nothing like they are in other countries. When you think that a country like East Germany, which has 65 year-round opera companies, and the United States doesn't have one. We don't have one year-round opera company. When you think of a country like West Germany, that at the end of the First World War, the very first year after that war was over, it allocated more money to go towards drama than we have in this country to this day per year for all of the arts. It depends on where one puts one's emphasis of what one thinks is important. But our regional theaters are starting to grow. They need to keep, well, unfortunately, one of the things that's happening to them is because they're all having difficulty subsidizing, paying for it. So what they're doing is going to smaller and smaller cast plays. They can do a two-character play rather than a six-character play, they'll do it. But it's also forcing down, the playwright, saying, well, I'm not going to write for 11 characters. I won't get my play done. Have any of you happened to see Nicholas Nickleby yet? Have you been to New York to see that? I saw that. It was the Royal Shakespeare Company is over here doing Dickens. The reason they finally did it, they were shamed into it. Trabhananda, when he was over in Russia, went to see them working on they were doing Dickens Pickwick Papers in Russia. And they've done a lot of Dickens over in Russia. And England had never done it, even though he was their author. And they'd been working 9 months on this, so he got mad and decided he was going to do it himself. Came back and worked on Nicholas Nickleby. They rehearsed that. They worked on it for over a year and a half, and then rehearsed it for over 6 months. Well, it is a fantastic show. It has 45 actors in it. It runs for 8.5 hours, plus a dinner break of an hour, so that you're there for 9.5 hours. There are 3 intermissions, so that you don't have to sit there all that time. But it is a fantastic experience. The unfortunate thing is that they're charging $100 to see it, $50 for each part of it. In England, they don't have to do that because they're subsidized there and it's regular ticket prices. The Schubert organization and the Niederlander, the two competing theater owners in New York City, have gotten together with the biggest producing organization, the McCann-Nugent, and the three organizations are presenting this thing, and they're absorbing the loss that they're going to take on this, which they think is going to be about $100,000. But the only way they could keep it to within $100,000 is to charge everybody $100. Now, naturally, that's going to limit who's going to see it. And also, it can only be here for 14 weeks. They can't afford to have it going any longer than that. The shame that everybody in this country can't see something like this is because it is about social subjects. It's about poverty. It's about what Dickens was constantly writing about, and something that our country needs to keep seeing. We're not going to get that kind of thing until we can start getting the kind of subsidization that we need. Our audiences, you all probably have one of the biggest audiences around. When I look at the figures that you all do, I think it's really terrific. And you don't even run year-round. And it's marvelous that you're getting these kind of people in. And I'm sure a lot of people are seeing theater for the very first time. I trust and hope what you're giving them is first class. I'm sure it is. But you've got to start with the very best actors. And I don't know whether all of the time you're able to afford that. You may not be able to. Sometime, I hope maybe we're going to be able to have that kind of money where that every actor is going to have that kind of security. We lose so many of our talented people, particularly more in the theater than we do in the other arts, because of the insecurity of the business. People very often are more interested and able to give money to the ballet companies, the opera companies, and the orchestras, because most people cannot dance on their toes, sing an aria, or play a musical instrument. But the majority of people in this country think anybody can act. They see too much evidence of it on television constantly. That a football player gets up with a bum knee and becomes a movie star, and they make a lot of money. And people all the time are getting on talk shows and say, well, I never had an acting lesson in my life. Well, that's another thing that television did to our theater company. It made everybody a star. See, I believe that there are three kinds of actors. I believe that they're, and this has nothing to do with talent, all of them talented. They're actors that can carry play. That you can put the burden of a play on them and they can take that burden. There are actors that can carry scenes, and there are actors that can support, and there are the need for all three kinds of actors. All talented, all well trained. Television can take a supporting actor and make a star out of them. They don't have to carry a play. Very often they don't have to carry a scene. They just have to be able to stand there until the next commercial, most of the time. And get those people to come back and try to get on the stage, which we've had some of them coming in, particularly some of the feature actors. We used to have marvelous feature actors. We had the first feature, second feature, third feature, and people stayed there. They didn't want to become stars. As you become a star, you take on a burden. You have to take on the burden of a play. And not everybody can do it. And that's not a crime if you can. And there were those marvelous feature actors that wanted to stay there their entire career. They go out to Hollywood, and Hollywood made stars out of all of them. And those people come back and they can't handle a full night on stage trying to carry a play, and yet they are a star. So their agent says, well, we're never going to do that again, and so they don't come back. And we've lost a whole lot of those marvelous older people. And it's too bad. With the acting company, with the Circle Repertory Company, we're hoping to keep our actors coming back constantly. Judd Hirsch comes back and does a show. Bill Hurt wants to do a show. These people want to come back. We cannot afford to pay them what they can make in movies and television, so we have to start working around the availability of the actor, of all the actors, the director too. So we have our playwrights writing for our actors, and what we have to do is we did on Tally's Folly. We did it down there at Circle Rep, and Judd had to go off and do Taxi. He said, all right, we'll wait till your hiatus. And as during his hiatus, he came back, and he and Trish did it on Broadway. We have to be working around their availability if we want to keep the actor coming back and working on stage. I mean, he can make more in a week doing an episode of Taxi. And the pay that they give those people is incredible. We cannot compete for that. We've got to just hope that the actor still wants for his own spirit to come back and work on stage. And the majority of the good ones do. What we have to have is acting companies around where that they can go do that. Working with a good company of actors, working around their time period. They can work on a piece of material they want to work on with a group of actors and a director that they want to work with. And at a time period where they're able to do it, and for a short period of time. We cannot expect a lot of those actors to give us a year of their life unless you want to say, all right, we'll pay you $50,000 a week, which they did with, I know, with Burton and Camelot. But also, look what happened with Camelot. Look at what they were charging, and look at where it had to go to play. It had to be playing in 5,000-6,000 seat houses. Now, this is another thing I say with great trepidation, because you all have such huge, huge places that you work with. I do believe that the theater, the spoken word, should be in a smaller house. I think somewhere between 4 to maybe 1,000 seats. I prefer something like around 850. But again, not so much on the number of seats, the cubic foot of space that one has to fill. That's even more important than the number of seats. One of the best theaters we have in New York is about a 750-seat house. It's the Booth, and it works very well. The Golden doesn't work, even though it's only 800 seats, because it's very long and it's kind of high, and it's the volume that the actor has to fill. And it's that ambiance between that actor audience. I believe also that most of our opera houses are too big. European opera houses are generally smaller. I think also our symphony halls are too big. Beethoven didn't write for 110-piece orchestra anyway. But we have to fill, you know, they keep adding more and more people in the orchestra. And you get the Metropolitan Opera, you get a singer, he has to sing over a 110-piece orchestra. Not every singer can do that. Also, do you think Mozart really wrote the Magic Flute for that size house? He did. You see it sometime in a 500-seat theater. And what that thing can become. But why do we do all of this? It all comes down to money. You all think, you know what I'm getting around to is money. Where do we get the money to be able to do this? How can we have a company like the Royal Shakespeare? Why don't we have something like that? We don't have the money for it because we think we've got to do it. If something is any good in this country, it's got to pay for itself. And a lot of people really do feel that way. If a police department is any good, it should pay for itself. If fire department is any good, it should pay for itself. The army is any good, it should pay for itself. The hospital is any good, it should pay for itself. It doesn't. We subsidize totally, as we do most things, out of fear. We give first to a disease, long before we'll give to the arts, because of out of fear. I think we do most things in this country. It's not us alone, but you do have to wonder why there are a lot of places that do, a lot of other countries that do support their arts. Of course, a number of them do not have the huge defense budget that we are forced to have by the role that we take within the world. This I do understand, but we've got to watch where we put our priorities in this country, because the art really represents the spirit. The arts really represent the spirit of any nation. How do we get more money? Well, it has to be done through fundraising. I know some of you are into that, because most of you still have to have some support coming from state. I think some may even get it from the NEA. You all are aware of what's happening with the NEA. The president's task force that he had to advise him on what to do with the both endowments has come back and said the endowments are a sound, good idea. I've been recently to a Northeast Assembly up in New Haven where we talked about the future of the performing arts. And the one thing that everyone did agree out of that whole thing is that we must be doing something towards setting a national policy for the arts and towards subsidizing it. How do we get people to where that they understand it? There are very, very few people that really participate in the arts in this country. A lot of that had to do with the way this country was formed, with the people coming in, fleeing out of Europe, a lot of the people that spread across the land were having to work so hard, and most of them were bringing with them religious persecution or persecution of some kind, or just starving to death. And the last thing they were thinking about is theater or music or anything else. They were simply into survival. And that permeated our entire land. It was only when we started getting people in to this country, mainly the Middle Europeans that started flowing in during the Industrial Revolution, that started bringing that theater-going habit, the habit of the arts, that had started developing more in this country. And because they came into New York, that helped New York develop into that arts center. People now, though, are starting to have more free time than they've had. And so they're spending more time at the arts. For a lot of them, it is a frightening, again, experience. The rise of all of the dinner theaters. How many of you have been to see dinner theaters? A lot of people had never been to theater at all, found it first at dinner theaters. Part of that happened with the affluence after the 50s of people that had particularly gone through the Depression as they started to learn to eat out, which is, again, a frightening experience if you haven't done it as an adult, have never dealt with a waiter, or a captain, or a menu that's in another language, or tipping somebody, how much you tip them. And once you learn, overcome that fear, and it is a frightening experience, we don't pay enough attention to the fear people bring into a theater or any other arts thing. But once they learn that, you could then put live CinemaScope television, because I think that's what most of the dinner theater is. But even that is getting better and better and better as we go along. And those people now are starting to come to New York. And they're coming to see the shows there. And Broadway is booming. But what is Broadway now? It is not the theater, the serious kind of theater that they had there when I first came to New York, where we were manufacturing plays. The manufacturing of plays is done now in the regional theaters and done in London mainly. What they do there is show some of those plays, and they're either bringing in retread musicals, very few new things, but it's mostly a Coney Island of theater, of the Sugar Babies and the Annies and the things like that. But people are going, they're flocking to them and paying a lot of money because it's entertainment. It is really mainly an entertainment industry now. It was the center, Broadway was the center of serious theater in New York, in the country. Now it's, you're finding it more and more in regional theaters. Off-Broadway is suddenly this year going to start, well, it's already started, to have a revival. Why? Because Broadway is charging so much money, you can now charge $20 off-Broadway and make money out of it and do some serious theater. So we're starting to see that happen again, which unfortunately is not good for Circle Rep because we're looking for other theaters. We now have 6,000 subscribers and we're having to do one of our shows with the Phoenix Theater, mainly because it takes place on the side of a mountain and our height is only 15 feet and we need about 35 feet as one of the guys falls off the mountain and has to climb back up again. But we're doing that show with them, and then we're doing our classic Rep with Bill Hurt and Chris Reeve and Richard Second with a new play called Jedediah Kohler, and we have to have another theater for that. And we now have a theater jam off-Broadway. I cannot find a $2.99 or even a $4.99 seat theater right at the moment. So if any of you know of one, I'd love to have it. But theater is changing very rapidly. Every one of these regional theaters is now starting to go into television. I don't know whether you all are being hit with cable television coming to you and asking about filming your show because they need a lot of programming. They're going to be somewhere between 70 and 100 different television channels. Your life is really going to change. You all are going to have television sets in every room. And some of them you're going to have several. Movies are starting, I think, to disappear. I don't know whether they're happening around here, but in New York, the screen is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. They're twinning every theater or quadrupling every theater. They're getting smaller and smaller. The television sets, screens are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. When they get to be the same size, movies, except for a few things like Star Wars, are going to disappear because you're going to be able to see it in your own home. You're going to have a 5x7 or a 9x12 television screen, and you're going to have terrific sound, stereo sound, quadraphonic sound. You're going to be able to do it all there, as well as doing all of your income tax. You're going to be able to order all of your groceries, everything by computer. In fact, you can have your whole kitchen set up so that you're using something, it's immediately being ordered as you run out of it. What is this going to do to all of us? I mean, we're headed towards this. There's no question about it. What's it going to do? More and more people are starting to work using word processors. More and more people are starting to look at television screens 8 hours during the day. As we start getting our main workforce in this country looking at a television screen, do you think they're going to want to come home at night and look at another television screen? I don't know. I don't know whether we're going to have that big boom that everybody thinks we're going to have in cable television. Maybe we will. Maybe it's going to be a different size screen enough to where that they won't mind it. But an awful lot of people are going to be working on television screens during the day. These channels that we're going to have, about 100 of them, they're going to be narrow broadcasting rather than broadcasting. So that it's going to be fewer and fewer people. It's going to be going to pay television. Maybe you'll be able to make money with the television cable system with only 3 million subscribers rather than 20 or 30 million that you need in the big networks now. It's going to change all of our lives. And we've got to keep watching. This is all part of that communication system. The communication system, too, I think for the first time, is maybe going to have something to do with our transportation system, particularly locally. If, for instance, you do not have to go to your office, because you can have your office at home and be plugged in through computers to everybody that you have to keep in contact with, suddenly you no longer have to travel from your home to your office or to other people. That's it. I don't know what kind of effect that's going to have on us, but we're starting to get where transportation and communication are going to start crossing one another. And it may get to where that we're eventually going to have, this is the 21st century, but you're going to be able to step into some kind of a machine at home and transport yourself by computer to another place at another time. I don't know. That may be the way we travel in the future. I don't know what's going to happen. But it's going to happen. Things are happening fast. And they're going to happen even faster. And we must keep abreast of them in order to stay halfway sane. Because it gets, you really get to where that you feel you cannot cope with all of it. Now, what does all this have to do with outdoor drama? Anything? You all do grab a hold of a lot of the actors when they first start coming out of school. I hope that they're going to be getting the very best kind of training and experience. I would like to think in outdoor dramas that they're going to be able to start working with the very best people. That is the secret always in working with a company, is to work with the best people, working with the best actors. I know an awful lot of young people want to come right into the theater and start playing all the leads. At Juilliard, where we got most of the people for the acting company when I was with it, for the first 2 years there, they didn't do any plays. It was 2 years spent. They also didn't have the opportunity, though, even of learning about dramatic literature. I found that those actors that came out of Juilliard, if they hadn't done the play, they may not know it. Because they didn't have dramatic literature, they didn't learn about history of the theater. They were learning how to fence, how to juggle, vocal stuff going on all of the time, body movement, mask work. Everything was totally towards their becoming a trained actor. And then they started doing plays, and in 2 years, the last 2 years, they came out with 9 plays in their repertoire. And then some of them stayed with it for another 5 years, and by the time they'd finished the other 5 years, they had added another 25 to 30 plays in their repertoire. I mean, it was a marvelous experience for those people. But we did keep them out on the road most about 9 weeks, nine months of the year. The other 3 months they were rehearsing. But it was the first time in my experience that I had a group of actors that we had on salary 52 weeks a year. They all got paid vacations, and they all got credit cards. And if any of you have ever been an actor in New York City and tried to get a Bloomingdale's credit card and you can't get it, you can't get on American Express because you're an actor. You're a bad risk. But they kept calling. They said, is this really an acting company? Are these kids really making that kind of money? I'd say, yes, they are. And they all have credit cards now. I don't know that they're living within their means. They're probably not. But they do all have credit cards. But the fact that anybody coming into this profession cannot count on any kind of security. We must start doing something about this if we're going to have the best artists working in this country, whether it's in the theater of the spoken word, or whether it's in opera, or whether it's in the ballet. There is very little security for people. The one thing about ballet dancers is that generally they can't go to something else. They have to stay with the ballet company. The unfortunate thing with the actors is that they can make livings as a commercial, doing commercials, or doing movies or television. They can make their living elsewhere. And we find that we keep losing them from the theater. And if we're going to hang on to them and develop a strong acting community in this country, we've got to do something about subsidizing theater and all theaters in this country. And I think it has to start with our federal government. We do, as I say, tend to do all our subsidizing of things out of fear, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Defense, Police, Fire, Sanitation, Hospitals, even churches, I think, is largely done out of fear. All diseases, most of our social programs. And so many of those things, I think so much could be done if we could help people overcome fear. What's the best way of helping anyone overcome any fear? Education. What makes people less frightened of the dark? Turn on a light. That's what education is. It's turning on a light. What is the best tool for helping people to learn? And I believe in a learning process rather than a teaching. And that we do all learn to walk and talk until we're a certain age, and we have to go into our compulsory educational system. From then on, we're going to be taught. We're not going to learn, we're going to be taught. And we need to substitute that learning process. What is the best tool to help people learn? I did experiments in mass education. When I first left Chapel Hill and went up to it, it was through the Navy Department, because I'd been in the Navy. I was an actor, and they put it together, and I found myself on television instructing naval cadets in gunnery and navigation on television. And it turned out it was a terrific way of helping people to learn. We used four different things. We used the straight lecture, which I am doing, which is the worst way of trying to get anybody, helping anybody to learn. We did round tables and panel discussions, which is a little bit better, but still not terrific. Then we did drama, which was terrific. And the best of all was variety shows, where there was music and dancing and drama all mixed together. That is absolutely the best way of helping anyone to learn anything. And here we have in the arts the very tool that will help people learn how important the arts are to their lives. We don't use it. We use it for television commercials. And those television dramas are really just little tiny playlets. They're there to make you buy something, to help you learn how this is why this is important in your life, because without it you're not going to be successful. People are not going to like it, or whatever it is. They're selling to you by using the very techniques that we have. We do it in industrial shows. We have the Buick show, the Oldsmobile show. One of the biggest and best shows was the Millikan show. Did anybody ever, it's just gone off. But they used to do those Millikan shows for 10 days, the Waldorf Astoria, in a stage that was so tiny it would make the old Playmaker stage seem like Lincoln Center. It was a tiny little stage. They would come out there and do, it's where I first ran into Michael Bennett. When he had to do all of these different, 22 totally different dances about fabric. And why this fabric was so terrific. And they were marvelous shows. They were $1 million when I first saw them. And by the end, over a 10-day period, they spent $3 million on these shows. And there were two shows a day for 10 days. And it cost $3 million to put this industrial show on to help people learn about this fabric. All internal, you know, they're all salespeople for this. And they're marvelous shows. That's where I knew that Michael Bennett was going to be brilliant. I mean, when you have to come up with 22 different ways of talking about some kind of a plaid fabric or something, I don't know. But it's really incredible. But here we have this thing and we don't use it. I keep saying what we should do is use this to help educate all of the people in this country. Why the arts must be funded at a level where we can win that arts race. Nobody in the country is interested in it. But I mean, every other single country in this world, with the possible exception of Ghana and a couple of others of that side, but they're all ahead of us. Right now, the NEA gives an average per capita, well, it was 77. They were going to cut it down to 35 cents. Per capita in this country, and maybe it's going to end up around 53 cents. And the country that is closest to us is Japan. If I remember, lost the war. But they spent $1.50 per capita. Austria, $100 per capita, goes towards the arts. We don't care in this country about the arts. And until we will do something about turning it around, that's when we're going to start getting something to happen. It is very difficult to get people to give, though, out of love, which is what we must try to do. You all, I know, know, do have to do some fundraising. You happen to hit a huge segment of the population of this country. Is anything that you all can do about getting those people to write to the congressman, write to the president, about the national endowment, and about increasing that? Corporations have already said they're going to follow whatever our federal government does. And I've talked to a number of the people on the big corporation, mostly the oil companies. They follow the lead of the government. And if they think that we're, that this tax cut has been proposed and probably will go through, is really going to hurt all giving to charities, not just the arts. I think the universities have already are aware of that and what it's going to do there. I know John Bradamus, who's just taken over as the president of NYU, had an article in today's New York Times about that, you know, what this new tax law is going to do there. Mr. Tara, the cultural ambassador of President Reagan, has said that he's got some ideas about how it can help. But all of you must be aware that there's a possibility. Forget what's happening to the NEA. I mean, that is going to end up about probably about a 12% cut, maybe as high as 20. But that's minuscule to what this other tax disincentive is going to do. That may mean something like a drop of over $18 billion in what is going to be coming to not-for-profit organizations. That's charity, all the charities. It's all the universities. It's all our whole educational system and everything. It's going to have a huge effect, and we all must take an interest in this. Because the thing, of course, that's going to get hurt the most are the arts, because that's going to be the first thing that everybody feels can go. And it shouldn't be that way, and we've got to do what we can about changing it. If there's anything that you can do with the audiences that you're reaching, I don't know where you all get your actors from, but I hope that you will see more and more that they are better trained. I know one of the things that the regional theaters are finding now, after 20 years of their being in existence, they're starting to find that they are getting less qualified actors coming to them. A lot of it has to do with economics, that they cannot pay very much money, so they're getting a poor class of actors, the actor that can't afford to go out there. A lot of times those actors that are going there may be talented, but have less training. And the school, all of you must realize, is the most important thing, particularly those of you that are connected with universities. George Balanchine, who we are trying to pattern our theater company after his ballet company, because that is the truest kind of a ballet, truest kind of company thing that we have in this country. He does choreography. He has his company, and no, there are no stars within his company. And he has his school. He said if he had to give up everything except doing one thing, he'd give everything up but the school, because he can always start over again with his school. And that's the most important place for that actor. What we have to do also in our educational systems is start getting down to that preschooler and the people in, that are just starting schools, that they get exposure to the arts. I mean, a lot of people don't know what a trombone is until they're 16 or 17. Kids should be getting that kind of exposure when they're very, very young, whether they're going to end up being an audience or whether they're going to end up being in an orchestra or with an opera company or in a theater. One company that I know that is doing marvelous work is Arthur Mitchell's. It's, again, it's a ballet company. Dance Theater of Harlem. And that man is taking kids off the street and exposing them to that dance company there. A lot of them will never go into dance. He's more proud, really, of the people that have ended up being doctors and lawyers that he's taken off the streets. And just as a social agency, he should be given a whole lot of money. But he is scrounging every single year trying to get enough money to operate. I don't know how all of you are set up,
I know you probably find it very easy getting money at the beginning as far as the building of your theater. What I advise everybody that is starting a cultural center is don't get just enough money to do that. Get enough money to operate your theater every single year as far as the operation of the theater. Then use your box office towards just the operation of those direct expenses with keeping that theater going so that you don't have to worry about the upkeep on it, about the repairs on it, about all of the money that has to go into all of the technical things you need. But just be worrying about the direct expenses for that particular year, as we do in New York, just our operational bills. I mean, the Circle Rep is not up to that, but I know several cities that are able to do this. Syracuse has done that. And what it took, though, was the guy that is running it, Joe.
Well, you all see it, any of you that have ever done any teaching. I mean, a kid comes into a class and the teacher says, I'm going to teach you. And the kid says, oh, I'm going to get enough. And the kid will win every time. He can beat that teacher where he's not going to learn anything. The kid always going to lose. And if this happens constantly to us, and it's happening all the time, we're going to have a lot of people in this country that are going to become adults that are going to be too frightened of any of these things, too frightened to learn anything. And learning a new experience, like going to the ballet, going to the theater, is a frightening experience for people. That's why you have access to so many of them. You're also giving them a learning experience as they go in there, because they're learning, as I understand it, in certainly the Lost Colony, they're learning about what happened at that period of time. And learning about Lincoln, or learning about any of the others, they are learning about, they're getting a learning experience there. So what you're doing is a terrific thing. Do it with the very best actors. See if you can get marvelous actors. Pay them more money. You're going to have to start paying more money. And you're not going to be able to get it all at the box office. And we must stop trying to think that that has to happen. Nickleby is costing $100 to see it here, where it costs the equivalent of maybe $22, I think, in England, to see that same thing. Why? Because they do subsidize. Here, we have to make it pay for itself. And all we're doing is cheating ourselves on this. I'm sorry to go on so long about all this fundraising. And I don't know whether this is going to help you all in your outdoor drama, but I tell you that things are going to be changing in the few years, and some of these things are going to have an effect on what happens to your theaters. And you should be part of the theater picture as a whole. And it's a marvelous place for new young actors to be going and starting to learn their craft. And it's also going to be the place, remember every person that comes in there, this may be the very first theatrical experience they have. Make sure it's a terrific one so that they'll come and see other theater. This past summer, my daughter was stage managing a show out in California with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. And a lot of people were coming because of those two men. And they did not get a good theatrical experience. I mean, the play was not very good, nor were they up to doing theater. And I don't think the majority of those people are going to go out of there and say, God, I can't wait to see another show. They're going to say, well, he didn't look as old as I thought he was going to look, or else he looked older than I thought. They say, well, but I don't think they were terribly impressed with that theatrical experience. I wish all of those people could go see Nicholas Nickleby. They'd be very impressed with that theatrical experience. 8.5 hours of it, and all coming from a company. We've got a company going. We had a fellow break an arm the other day, and the very next day, two other people were in the show. One of them, a member of our company, that had not been understudying. But he came in and he did that part in 24 hours. And it was because it was a company, we didn't have to worry about people getting to know other people in the company. They know them already. And they can step in terribly fast. The difference between having a company and having to form a company each time you're doing a play is incredible. The need to be working longer. I know you all are having trouble here, even doing things in 2 and 3 and 4 weeks. We should be working on things over a period of months, but we keep because of our speed, everything traveling so fast, we keep wanting to make things go faster. You cannot do that in the creative process. It still takes about a year and a half to do a new play from the beginning to the end. We keep thinking we can shorten that creative time. You cannot do it any more than you can ask women of this country to start having babies in 5 months rather than 9, because we need to get them back in the workforce. The creative process takes time, and you've got to allow it to happen. And that does take money, I'm afraid. And everything eventually does come down to that. Thank you for listening to all this. If you have any questions about why, what this hell has to do with outdoor drama, I'd be delighted to try to figure out how to answer that. Thank you.
On behalf of everyone here, sir, may I thank you for sharing your invaluable insight to the world of professional theater with us tonight. And thank you so much. Before we adjourn, I need to introduce to you Mr. Robert Dale Martin, who will comment on the Samuel Selden Memorial Scholarship.
I'm very honored to have been on the same bill with Porter, or Pete as we know him affectionately. He's a very, very special man in this business, and I think the university should be very proud to have him among its graduates. Just one quick thing about him. In 1952, I was going to buy my first house. I needed $1,650 for a down payment, and I could raise $1,250. And I really, it was up at the deadline, I had to have another $400 quick. And I knew this fellow. We'd met in New York. We'd both been in the Lost Colony different times, both been at the University of North Carolina different times, but we got acquainted making the rounds as actors. So I said to him one day, I said, would you lend me $400? And he said, sure, when do you need it? And that's the kind of guy he is. And Pete, I want to say I have every intention of paying him. That's a joke.
Just
a hedge of it's being
but
won.
I want to borrow some
bucks. So right. See, that's a joke. Keep it loaded. One more thing. I just can't understand how they're taking in almost $1 million a week for Nicholas Nickleby and they still can't make the nut. Okay. But what I'm really here for in Chapel Hill just a couple of days for is to huddle, as we say in Variety, with a few people about an idea whose time has come, and that is to memorialize Samuel Selden, whom almost everyone here knew and with great affection. And what best way to memorialize him than with a scholarship fund for playwrights. We know his great interest in the writer. And so I'll be meeting with a few people, and certainly Mrs. Selden, Emily, and we hope that in the very, very near future we can announce that a substantial scholarship fund has been established for playwrights at the University of North Carolina School of Theater.
I'd like to thank Mark Sumner, Dr. Morrow, and all involved at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for their hospitality and for bringing us this session and this marvelous meal. I would like to thank Robert Dale Martin for not getting too terribly upset with me when I forgot to introduce him earlier in the program when I was supposed to. I would especially like to thank again Porter Van Zandt for sharing his insight with us. And I would like to thank all of you for being here tonight. And I would like to thank you in advance for being on time, promptly, for tomorrow morning session. As my favorite country and western singer would say, Lester Rodog Moran, at 9 o'clock a.m. in the morning, at the Holiday Inn. Thank you, and this meeting stands adjourned. Yes.